on to the second case of the day, that being 092984, 092985, Becker v. Ward Feed, Incorporated. Morning, Mr. Wallach.
Good morning, Judge Roedner, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Daniel Wallach, counsel for the appellant, Becker & Polyakov, PA. Becker & Polyakov is an administrative creditor of the bankruptcy estates of Berwick Black Cattle and its principal, or former principal, Mark Ray. Becker & Polyakov seeks a reversal of the District Court's July 30, 2009 order affirming the Bankruptcy Court's dismissal of the debtor's Chapter 11 cases and denying the Committee of Unsecured Creditors' motion for the appointment of a Chapter 11 trustee.
Now, is a cross-appeal necessary for us to consider our jurisdiction to hear an appeal? You know, normally if a party doesn't have Article III standing and our jurisdiction is at issue, we can and must consider jurisdiction whether or not the parties have raised it. In arguing for the necessity of a cross-appeal, are you relying on the fact that this is not Article III standing that we're talking about, but some standing under bankruptcy law?
In a way, yes, Your Honor. Typically, when one thinks of standing as a subset of subject matter jurisdiction, there are similar concepts in normal federal jurisdiction. But in the bankruptcy context, standing has to do with whether or not a particular appellant is an aggrieved person, not whether there's a case or controversy under normal Article III civil litigation guidelines. So I think the concepts, while they have the same nomenclature, standing, they really are not the same kinds of standing that one would think about in a non-bankruptcy Article III case or controversy issue.
So, Mr. Walk, are you arguing that the Seventh Circuit's line of cases that says that standing is not subject to waiver or forfeiture is not applicable because bankruptcy standing is different?
I'm not sure what you mean, Your Honor.
The Seventh Circuit has said repeatedly that standing is not an issue that is subject to waiver or forfeiture. And as I understood your briefs, you were saying that opposing counsel waived the bankruptcy standing issue because they didn't file a cross appeal.
Yes, I made that argument, Your Honor,
okay.
And I still stand on it. But beyond that, there are numerous other reasons why Becker & Polyakov has standing to pursue this bankruptcy appeal.
And certainly I want to hear that. I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, though. Are you saying that the Seventh Circuit's, because bankruptcy standing is different, those cases that clearly say that standing is not subject to waiver or forfeiture refer to the case or controversy standing only, not to bankruptcy standing?
Yeah, I don't have a case that's on point which, counters the Seventh Circuit line of cases that Your Honors refer to. But if that is indeed the case, I'll relent on that point. But I do want to point out that there are some distinct differences between normal Article III standing and the person aggrieved concept of standing under bankruptcy law. They're somewhat different.
Talk about In re Andrew.
In re Andrew Chetty?
Chetty.
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, the Seventh Circuit held that the prospect of litigation recoveries was, I believe, a sufficient basis upon which to aggrieved person could look to for eventual recoveries. In our case, we have more than just what the lower courts referred to as speculative hypothetical litigation recoveries. We have actual filed avoidance actions which are supported by prima facie evidence, namely the debtor's sworn schedules that it filed in the bankruptcy court conceding that approximately $2 million worth of transfers were made to the secured parties within 90 days prior to the filing of the bankruptcy petition, which transforms those payments presumptively into voidable preferences. So we're at a stage where we're not just simply looking down the road and, you know, maybe we'll recover something, who knows. We actually have sworn admissions from the debtors that these payments were made to the secured creditors within the 90-day preference period.
Mr. Wallach, you seem to concede in your reply that in addition to the person aggrieved aspect of standing, that you also need to appear and object for standing purposes. Is that fair? Do you agree
with
that?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a line of Seventh Circuit precedent that I am not abandoning or running from.
And if I understand your argument, you agree that you personally did not appear or object in the bankruptcy court. Is that correct?
Me personally, no, I didn't, but my partner.
And you didn't file anything to object? I know you didn't appear, but you didn't file, you personally?
Me personally, Daniel Wallach, not
yes.
my law firm.
Or you on behalf of your client did not file something objecting to the submissions to dismiss the bankruptcy.
I personally had no involvement in the bankruptcy court proceedings, and I'm the appellate attorney who is my injection into the case began with the filing of the notice of appeal. My law firm, however, my former partner, Ivan Reich, who left Becker and Polyakov and joined another law firm, appeared on behalf of both the Committee of Unsecured Creditors and the administrative claimants in the telephonic hearings below.
That's something that I'm very interested in because you've contended that Attorney Reich represented you at the omnibus hearing. Where in the record will we find Mr. Reich entering an appearance on behalf of Becker or informing the court at the omnibus hearing that he, Mr. Reich, was representing both the committee and Becker? Because in looking at the beginning of the transcript, Reich says that he's there, quote, for the committee. I don't see any mention of Becker. And I would think that the committee would have had to consent to this dual representation, especially since the interests of the former counsel and the committee, you know, they're not always aligned. So it's odd.
There was a hearing 1 week earlier, I believe December 15th, 2008, on the telephonic hearing relating to the motion to appoint a Chapter 11 trustee, and Mr. Reich does mention the administrative claimants.
But does he say he's representing them? He may mention them, but does he say Mr. Reich on behalf of the committee as well as the administrative claimants,
on
behalf of the Becker?
Where in the record that appears is in his secured parties filed a motion to dismiss the initial appeal for lack of standing, and Mr. Reich filed a declaration, a sworn declaration.
But did he ever tell the bankruptcy court that?
That he appears on behalf of Becker and Polyakov?
Yes.
No, but he mentioned that he's there to protect the rights of the administrative claimants. I don't have the transcript in front of me. I will point that or highlight that for Your Honor, you know, if I can have an opportunity subsequent to the hearing.
Are you saying just because he says he wants to protect them that that is a formal appearance for purposes of standing?
No. He said that also in his sworn declaration, which was not controverted or rebutted by the appellees. He filed the declaration in support of the memorandum of law in opposition to the motion to dismiss appeal, and he represented that he was there. He was representing both Becker and Polyakov as well as the Committee of Unsecured Creditors. That was not contradicted or controverted by the appellees. And moreover, Becker and Polyakov directly appeared in connection with the dismissal order by filing a motion for reconsideration in January of 2009, and that's part of the bankruptcy court record and the district court record. In addition, Becker and Polyakov, the appellant, filed an emergency motion for a tolling order to extend the expiration of the statute of limitations so that the committee would be able to file additional adversary proceedings against insiders and related parties of the debtor.
So, Becker, so are you arguing if you don't appear and object at the hearing and the court rules that it's sufficient for standing purposes if you come in after the fact and file a motion for reconsideration?
But we were the
is
understanding.
That your argument?
Well, the agreement between the agreement between Becker and Polyakov and Mr. Reich was that he would represent Becker and Polyakov at the hearing. That was the understanding.
That may be the understanding. Here, you know, we kind of have the same problem that we had in the last case. I mean, either you come into court and say, "Hello, Judge, I'm here representing Becker and Polyakov and the committee." I couldn't find that. So I don't want you to look for it now because that would be a terrible waste of your time. But perhaps you'll let us, within 10 days, by letter, let us know where this exists.
I mean, Mr. Reich made argument, advocated and championed the position of the administrative claimants at the hearing before the bankruptcy judge. I'm going to point out page 12. Of the appellant's reply brief. And Mr. Reich, the committee, through Mr. Reich, made specific reference to the rights and interests of administrative claimants.
But does that mean he's representing them?
Why would he have argued the, you know, position of administrative claimants if he was there representing the Committee of Unsecured Creditors?
It seemed. So you think it does mean he's representing them? To say, make an argument on behalf of them?
But if he did not say the words, "I'm here representing the committee and Becker and Polyakov," well, the absence of those words "and Becker and Polyakov" should not be fatal to the position that we appeared and objected based upon the tenor of Mr. Reich's argument, where he views the committee and the administrative claimants, which include Becker and Polyakov, in lockstep throughout the proceeding.
Did he inform the appellees that he was there representing Becker?
I can't answer that. I don't know the answer to that question.
Because time is so short, let's ask you this. How are the unsecured creditors in any worse position as a result of the dismissal? It's not as if the debtors received a discharge. The unsecured creditors can make their fraudulent transfer claims in state court.
That might be true with respect to fraudulent transfer claims, Judge Rovner, but that is not the case with respect to preference actions. The adversary complaints that are part of the record below set forth approximately $2 million worth of preferential transfers that Ward Feed Yards and High Plains Credit Corporation received from the debtors within the 90-day preference period. With the dismissal of those, with the dismissal of the bankruptcy cases, so too does the ability to recover on a preference claim disappear, because those are purely creatures of bankruptcy law and the bankruptcy courts, and may not be pursued in a state court forum. And there's a Supreme Court decision that sets forth that principle, as well as many other cases from the lower courts. The case is called Eau Claire, EAU, National Bank, 200, U.S., 522nd. It's an older case from 1907, but it carries forward in a line of later cases. And the bankruptcy court and the district court also got it incorrect when they focused on the fact that the debtors were farmers. Farmer.
Did you ask for a hearing on the issue of whether the debtor was a farmer?
Absolutely.
Where in the record are we going to find that request? Because in the transcript of the omnibus hearing, I saw Mr. Reich saying, "Now, we're not in a position to put evidence on today on this particular issue, but the fact of the matter is that the way Mr. Ray operated his business was not as you would call a, quote, farmer, unquote." I didn't see Mr. Reich asking for a hearing.
Judge Rovner, we didn't even need to reach the question at that hearing of whether the debtors were farmers, and I'll tell you why. One status as a farmer in the bankruptcy code, it's an affirmative defense that needs to be raised in response to the involuntary bankruptcy petition or in response to the initial petition. Otherwise, it's waived. I have several cases, Your Honor, that stand for that proposition. I mean, it is critical. This was a consented to order for relief. When the unsecured creditors filed an involuntary bankruptcy petition against the debtors, if they believed that they were farmers, they could have challenged the filing of the involuntary by claiming that they're farmers. And under the bankruptcy code, an involuntary bankruptcy petition is not allowed to be filed against farmers. I mean, that's black letter law.
Well, right. Of course, a bankruptcy court can't force a liquidation of a farm.
Exactly. But what did the debtors do in this instance?
To appoint a trustee and no authority to order a liquidation.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
So where's the authority to appoint a trustee and where's the authority to order a liquidation?
Well, the authority to order the appointment of a trustee stems from Section 1104A3, that if there's cause for dismissal of a bankruptcy case, notwithstanding the existence of cause, if it's in the best interest of creditors to appoint a trustee, the bankruptcy court, quote-unquote, shall appoint a trustee.
What was the evidence that it was in the best interest of the creditors? What was the evidence that was presented to the bankruptcy court?
The existence of four adversary complaints filed against the secured parties.
But the bankruptcy court, in a 13-page opinion, found that those were really speculative. What evidence would counter that?
The debtors' sworn schedules. In response to question three on the debtors' sworn schedules filed under oath in the bankruptcy court, the debtors admitted that they made payments of approximately $2 million within the 90-day period prior to the filing of the bankruptcy petition to the secured creditors, Ward Feed Yards, and High Plains Credit Corporation. So to disparage an actual filed litigation as quote-unquote speculative in the face of, one, sworn admissions by the debtor, and number two, we had a plan of confirmation, a Chapter 11 plan that was almost confirmed, under which Ward Feed Yards agreed to pay approximately $1 million and to fund the avoidance proceedings and to pay certain administrative expenses. They agreed to fund those and pay $1 million, and the bankruptcy court, in a September 2008 opinion, denied the proposed plan for confirmation because the scope of the releases given to the secured creditors were overbroad and rejected it on that basis. So you had a secured creditor that was willing to fork over $1 million until the bankruptcy court said, no, 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 the release is too broad. If you narrow the scope of the release, we might have a plan of confirmation. So you have the debtor's sworn schedule showing, you know, seven figures worth of preferential transfers, the Ward Feed Yard's willingness to fund $1 million plus more into a plan, and the inability to pursue these preference recoveries in state court. So, you know, clearly we're in a position where if the dismissals of bankruptcy cases hold, the unsecured creditors walk away with zero. If the cases are allowed to proceed, you've got four avoidance actions with the prospect of additional avoidance actions against insiders and related parties of the debtors. I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. We're talking millions of dollars here at zero cost to the estate because both the proposed trustee and the lawyers representing the Committee of Unsecured Creditors had agreed to handle the case on a contingent fee basis.
But that same money will be available through state court fraud cases now that the bankruptcy is dismissed.
But not for preference actions. The ability to reach back and bring back into the estate or to recover the $2 million worth of preferential transfers, that is lost once the bankruptcy cases are dismissed, because you can't bring a preference claim in a state court or federal district court proceeding. It's purely a creature of bankruptcy law.
I'm going to stop you because I'm going to stop you. But I, even though you've used all your time plus, I will give you, a minute or two for rebuttal. Because we were asking you a lot of questions. How many more minutes than we give to Mr. Wallach? Three? Okay. We'll add 3 minutes to your time if you want it, Mr. Wool.
Thank you, Judge Ripple, Judge Rovner, and Judge St. Eve. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here on behalf of the appellees, Ward Feed Yard and ILS Financing. First on the issue of the cross appeal, we believe the standing of required is an aggrieved person, and that's not Article 3, standing, but it is a prudential standing, and we don't believe that that can be waived. Second, we were the prevailing party in the district court. We were not injured by the district court's affirmance of the bankruptcy court. In any respect, the court can raise standing on its own, and we properly raised standing in our brief. And I think standing is determinative here. I think in order to have appellate standing, appellant must have appeared and objected in the bankruptcy court. And I think, Judge Rovner, you're correct. There's absolutely no evidence in the record where committee counsel represented to the court and made an appearance on behalf of the Becker firm.
You know, in footnote 3 of your brief, you stated without any citation that the bankruptcy code prohibits a lawyer from representing both prior counsel for the committee and the committee itself. I would like a cite to the part of the bankruptcy code that prohibits this dual representation so that
yes, Your Honor.
You have to crawl through the bankruptcy code to find it.
I understand, Your Honor. We cited to our filings made in the district court, but the bankruptcy code section is section 1103. And there it says that counsel for the committee cannot represent any entity with an adverse interest to unsecured creditors. In this case, the Becker firm has an adverse interest to unsecured creditors because their claim is entitled to priority over unsecured creditors. So the bankruptcy code prohibits that representation. And that's in addition to the fact that nowhere in the record and that in no hearing did counsel for the unsecured creditors committee, Ivan Reich, enter an appearance on behalf of the Becker firm. With respect to whether or not a motion to reconsider can cure the absence of the Becker firm's failure to appear and object, we believe that it cannot. I think that holding such would render the rule meaningless. If any party failed to appear and object, it could simply file a notice to reconsider instead of filing a notice of appeal, and then it would have appellate standing.
If the bankruptcy court had denied the Becker firm's fee petition, would the Becker firm be a person aggrieved under the bankruptcy code?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Not in this circumstance when we're dealing with the dismissal of the bankruptcy cases. I think the Becker firm has a pecuniary interest in their administrative claim, and to the extent the bankruptcy court denied their administrative claim, the Becker firm would be able to appeal that. But here we're talking about the dismissal of the bankruptcy cases.
Yeah, in footnote 4 of your brief, you said the Becker firm's fee application was not even allowed by the bankruptcy court. But that's because the court never ruled on it, right? And isn't that effectively a denial?
Well, it's part because the bankruptcy court never ruled on it. It's also in part because the Becker firm had agreed to delay being paid until, you know, after the plan was to be confirmed. The Becker firm admits in its filings that it was paid, and that it's not so much that the fee application was denied, but it's that they didn't agree to receive payment before the dismissal of the bankruptcy cases.
The assets are all gone, aren't they?
That's correct,
Your
Honor.
There's no business left to run, is there?
There's no business left to rehabilitate. There's no funds.
What are we doing?
Your Honor, I'm defending an appeal.
Okay.
And if the court was to reach the merits, yeah, I think it's clear, as Your Honor just noted, that it's just simply not feasible to appoint a Chapter 11 trustee.
Mr. Wohl, what's the appropriate standard that the bankruptcy court should have applied on the appointment of a Chapter 11 trustee, clear and convincing or preponderance of the evidence? Because I don't think this circuit has decided.
I don't think the circuit has decided either. We'd submit it's clear and convincing, but I think in this case it doesn't matter. No evidence was presented.
Why do you think it should be clear and convincing?
I think the appointment of a Chapter 11 trustee is an extraordinary remedy, and I think that that is reflected in countless cases in the bankruptcy court. And I think because it's an extraordinary remedy and it dispossesses the debtor of his business, it should require an additional heightened level of evidence. And I think That standard was not met in this case. No evidence was submitted.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Continue your answer to the judge.
I was finished, Your Honor. Please.
I wondered if you'd address whether this limitation on appointing a trustee or the limitation on conversion to Chapter 7 really ought to be applicable in a case like this. I mean, wasn't that restriction really put in place to protect farmers from involuntary total liquidation? Here, assuming this fellow's a farmer, and we have to at this point, he's not here. He's been liquidated. This is a fight, as you point out, between secured and unsecured creditors. There's an old rule when the rationale for the law ends itself. We're not protecting the farmer here. Why should we worry about whether we can convert this to a Chapter 7?
Well, I think the code is clear that the determination of whether when the debtor is a farmer is made the year prior to the petition date. And that's just the clear language of the code. There's no sort of sliding scale that if the debtor liquidates its assets
so
in bankruptcy.
You'd have to rely on the plain language of the code, not the rationale for that plain language. Am I right?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. But, you know, it was never contested in the bankruptcy court as to whether or not the debtors continued to operate a farming business. Granted, there were no assets left. But I believe, and, you know, we could go outside the record, but...
We can't.
Right. It's debatable whether or not the debtor or Mark Ray continued to be a farmer.
Well, what's to prevent a farmer debtor in a case like this from making a bunch of preferential payments to his buddies, then liquidating and filing a motion to dismiss before his creditors can go after the preferential payments? It sounds to me like we're setting this up really for a real abuse of the law.
Well, I think that's part of the purpose of the Unsecured Creditors Committee. If the Unsecured Creditors Committee really thought that was happening here, then it would have moved to prosecute these actions earlier. I think now, after dismissal, it's saying that, you know, all these things took place, but at that time, the Creditors Committee supported every sale, and they supported the liquidation of the debtor's assets.
Mr. Wool, there are some cases, and one from the Sixth Circuit BAP, one from the Middle District of Tennessee, one from the District of Kansas, where bankruptcy courts, despite this farmer prohibition, have in fact converted to Chapter 7. So how do you distinguish those cases?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with those cases. I know that there are some cases where a court will allow a liquidation plan in a Chapter 11 as opposed to converting the case because of the statutory prohibition. In this case here, Your Honor, there's, you know, no evidence put on that a Chapter 11 liquidating plan could ever be confirmed.
Tell me about the difference. Put a chapter, you said not
a Chapter 7 is
not converted to a Chapter 7, but...
Correct, Your Honor.
But what do what?
Propose a plan of reorganization, but it's called a liquidating plan.
Liquidating plan.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not technically a Chapter 7, but it is liquidating the debtor's assets. There are some courts that hold that statutory prohibition of involuntary conversion to a Chapter 7 isn't implicated when you have a Chapter 11 liquidating plan because it's within the framework of Chapter 11.
Going back to your plain language argument on the issue of the applicability of the farmer provision, here we're not, by appointing a trustee, we really wouldn't be violating that provision, except if we buy the argument made by the district court that it would amount to the same thing. Am I right? So it's not really a violation of the plain language.
Well, I would agree, but I think that in the bankruptcy court, the movements for the appointment of a Chapter 11 trustee, part of their argument was that a Chapter 11 trustee should be appointed just so that the Chapter 11 trustee could then convert the case and sort of make an end run around this.
De facto convert.
Exactly, Your Honor.
De facto convert. So my point is you're relying on the plain language rather than the underlying rationale. And the this case really doesn't involve the plain language. It involves the underlying rationale, whether there's anything, any farmer to protect.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. We're following the plain language, but it's also not exactly clear as to whether or not the debtors were still farmers. That was not...
Well, as you say, we've got to stay in the record on that one.
Precisely, Your Honor. Your Honor, unless you have any more questions, we argue that this appeal should be dismissed as the appellant lacks standing, or on the alternative that the bankruptcy court's order should be affirmed.
Judge Ripple, you asked a question about the status of farmer and this notion of a de facto conversion. The debtors did not establish they were farmers. As I mentioned earlier, one's status as a farmer is something that has to be filed in response to the bankruptcy petition, and the debtors didn't file any response to the initial petition, and they consented to the order for relief that was entered. And there's a case, In Re McCloy, M.C., capital C, L-O-Y, 296, F-3rd, 370, 5th Circuit, 2002, as well as In Re Mendez, 367, F-3rd, 109, 9th Circuit, Bankruptcy Appellate Panel, 2007, that stand for the proposition an individual status as a farmer is an affirmative defense that can be waived. That's a quote in both cases. The debtor did not assert that it was a farmer, and as a result, it waived its ability to claim farmer status through and including the balance of the bankruptcy cases. That being the case, the farmer concept is out. This notion of a de facto conversion is out. They didn't allege they were farmers. Henceforth, they are not farmers.
Mr. Wallach, you're not appealing, though, the ruling declining to convert the case to a Chapter 7, are you? You're just appealing the Chapter 11 portion.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And Your Honor, there are several other points, especially Judge St. Eve. You questioned the standard of review, whether it was preponderance or clear and convincing evidence. In a fraud-type setting, you can make a case for clear and convincing evidence because that's typically associated with fraud cases. But this is not – we're just saying that this is in the best interest of creditors because the pursuit of avoidance recoveries will ensure or lead to the expectation that the secured – that the unsecured creditors will get something as opposed to nothing. So I think a lower threshold would be appropriate in a non-fraud context. And
What about Mr. Wool's argument that it's an extraordinary remedy and therefore should have the higher standard, which is, I think, why the Third Circuit has ruled that there should be a higher, clear and convincing standard?
Under either context, I think it's satisfied here, Your Honors, given the fact that we have debtors who claim they're farmers yet never asserted it in the response to the petition. We have four avoidance actions that seek the recovery of millions of dollars worth of preferential transfers. You also have the need for a trustee to disgorge the attorney's fees that have been paid to the debtors.
But how do we deal with the fact that you never asked for a hearing on that issue?
That we never – I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You never asked for a hearing on the issue of whether the debtor was a farmer.
Well, we did challenge the debtor's status as a farmer. And we did ask for the court to inquire into that because we believe that the debtor really ran an elaborate Ponzi scheme in which he sold investments based upon cattle. These weren't your typical, you know, farming operations. This was an elaborate Ponzi scheme, and we never believed, and to this day, contest the notion that the debtor is a farmer. And we sought to characterize the debtors as non-farmers, and the bankruptcy court believed that it was, quote-unquote, unquestioned. That was the language used in the bankruptcy court's opinion, that it's unquestioned that the debtors are farmers. How could it be unquestioned if there was never a hearing to ascertain the amount of, you know, revenues that were earned by the debtors in the last year preceding the bankruptcy? And how can it be unquestioned?
But didn't the bankruptcy court find that the debtor's status as a farmer was unchallenged? And in footnote 2, page 5 of the opinion specifically say that no one had presented evidence that they didn't qualify for that, and no request for a hearing or an opportunity to present evidence was made.
But that's something that the bankruptcy court should have taken on as a result of the hearing before. We were seeking the appointment of a...
Nobody asked for it. Nobody asked for a hearing. Nobody asked to present evidence.
wasn't, as I'm saying, Your Honor, it was unnecessary because the status of a farmer is waived. It's waived by virtue of the fact that it was not asserted by the debtors in response to the initial involuntary bankruptcy petition. That's when they should have raised it. And having not raised it, it's something that they lose for the balance of the bankruptcy proceedings. And there are a couple of other points of error in the bankruptcy court's decision, which I didn't have an opportunity to discuss. And
I'm afraid I can't give it to you because... Okay. I've given you 5 extra minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll stand on the briefs which were filed. Thank you for the opportunity to present the appellant's case.
Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement.